Welcome to Half Hour of Heterodoxy, featuring conversations with scholars and authors and ideas from diverse perspectives. Here's your host, Chris Martin.
Amy Westervelt is my guest today. She's an award-winning print and audio journalist. She contributes to The Guardian, The Wall Street Journal, and The Washington Post. And in 2015, she received a Rachel Carson Award, and in 2016, an Edward R. Murrow Award for her environmental journalism. She's the creator and host of the podcast Drill, the first true crime-style podcast about climate change, and also the most popular podcast about climate change. We'll be talking about that podcast today. The first season of the podcast traced the corporate-funded messages that promoted a positive view of the fossil fuel industry in the face of climate science. One episode included a segment on universities such as Stanford, Harvard, and MIT that appeared to change their research agenda to continue receiving funds from the energy industry. The current third season digs into the longer history of the American propaganda industry. Amy also founded the Critical Frequency Network, a podcast network which she describes as a platform for independent creators and those who are often overlooked in mainstream media. Your podcast, Drill, is about how the energy industry has influenced the general public and influenced other industries. And since this is a higher ed podcast, I'd like to talk about how the energy industry has influenced higher education. What do we know about those attempts so far?
I know that, you know, the vast majority of climate research centers on kind of top tier university campuses are majority funded by fossil fuel companies and have been for quite some time, I would say at least 10 years and possibly more. And in the vast majority of cases, they do have quite a bit of say over what gets funded and what doesn't. And that's, you know, it's concerning. I think there was some recent kind of social media beef about this, where a lot of climate scientists and, you know, political scientists who study climate and things like that felt like people were saying that they were all in the pocket of fossil fuel. And that's certainly not true. And I don't think that, you know, 100% of research is being influenced by fossil fuel money. But I do think it's interesting to look at where the sort of research agenda has been pointed, particularly on the solution side of things, and how much funding has had to do with that. I think, you know, most of the research on carbon capture and geoengineering and algae biofuels and all of that kind of stuff tends to come from fossil fuel companies. And there's definitely, you know, they have an interest there, right? So, you know, carbon capture helps them kind of maintain the status quo. Algae biofuels, you don't have to replace the combustion engine. So it doesn't create this sort of massive overhaul of the systems that fossil fuel runs into. So yeah, there's definitely some stuff to look at there. And I think it's good for people to be aware of just how much, you know, oil companies do try to direct the research agenda in the U.S.
And on those two issues and other issues, do we have testimony from people within the energy industry or the fossil fuel industry that explicitly ties funding to the expectation that this will not affect the popularity of the combustion engine and fossil fuels?
There's definitely some stuff about algae biofuels and the preference for that in the biofuels realm. Because of its, because it can be used in the combustion engine. So we do have some documentation of that. There's not anything, as far as I know, of oil companies, you know, specifically saying in meetings, oh, let's fund this research center so that we can get them to focus on carbon capture. You know, those meetings may or may not have happened, but we don't have documentation of them. So what we do know is that there has been sort of a steady increase in funding in these research centers, and that you do see a correlation between fossil fuel funding and a research center's focus on solutions that don't require fossil fuels to stop being developed, that don't require oil and gas companies to sort of get out of the fossil fuel business. Which to me, for me, that's interesting on a couple of points. I mean, I think that it definitely shapes the broader cultural conversation around climate. You know, I talk to a lot of people who kind of especially point to carbon capture. Carbon capture technology really seems to be this thing that that people want to be valid and helpful. You know, it sounds like a huge relief if we could have this technology that just sucks all the carbon out, because not only could we potentially stave off the more extreme impacts of climate change, but there's even this sort of we could reverse the clock kind of thinking on that that's appealing to people. So you're definitely seeing that make its way into a lot of conversations. But then, of course, it provides a whole foundation for policy. And a lot of policymakers will point to academic research as their justification for proposing certain things. So I don't think that it's any accident that oil and gas companies figured, we should get into the research business. And they've long had partnerships with universities, and for a long time they had their own, for a long time oil and gas companies invested more in their own sort of internal research departments. And then there was this gradual shift kind of starting in the 90s to fund research elsewhere. I don't think there's any documentation of that being particularly a strategic move done to lend credibility to research that they wanted done or anything like that, although I wouldn't be surprised if that's the case. But there was this shift, and they're now heavily invested in a lot of university research centers.
And in season one of the podcast, you interviewed Ben Franta and Jeff Supron, Jeffrey Supron, about a specific case at the Harvard Business School. Tell me a bit about that case and what we know about the research that Franta and Supron are doing.
Yeah, Harvard is a really interesting case. And at the time when they first started working together, I think Ben was at Harvard and Jeffrey was at MIT, and they looked at both of those campuses and found, MIT has got just loads of fossil fuel funding. And they both kind of said, anecdotally, that they noticed that there were certain ways that these companies were influencing what they were kind of allowed to talk about or research, which is weird for an academic, Jeffrey tells this story about going to an event that was hosted at MIT, and there was a documentary that had been produced by Shell that was sort of we need to look for solutions on climate and not regulation and, all that kind of stuff. And he asked a question about, whether whether there was a conflict of interest there and whether, they should really be looking at this without any sort of input from the fossil fuel companies. And he, was sort of vaguely threatened that if he wanted to continue doing research, he needed to stop asking those kinds of questions, And then Ben was at the Kennedy School at Harvard at the time and was told, he and several other postdocs were told not to answer any questions from press people about where their funding came from, which again is a very weird thing, for an academic to be told, keep quiet about this funding.
Yeah, in general, when you publish, you are supposed to report where you got funding from. That's the convention in academia.
Yeah. So, it's sort of, there's the Harvard Business School, there's the political science kind of program at Harvard too, has quite a few fossil fuel guys. In fact, the president of the American Enterprise Institute has just left that organization, which is sort of a dark money funded think tank that often pushes climate denial, to become a professor at Harvard, I believe in the Kennedy School. So there's a lot of, there's definitely kind of a revolving door between the fossil fuel industry and Harvard. It's unfortunate. Mm.
Do we know which other universities, if the list isn't too long, which other universities fossil fuel companies are donating money to with some expectation of reciprocity?
Yeah. So actually, there was a really good report that came out in 2010. So it's pretty old now, but I was checking this morning to make sure that none of these universities have kind of changed their minds about taking oil money. And in fact, they have not. So let's see. This was from the Center for American Progress. I don't know if you've seen this report. It's called Big Oil Goes to College. Oh, it's really good. I'll send this to you after this because it's totally worth checking out. It's really well done. But I know, I mean, off the top of my head, I can tell you Stanford, MIT, Harvard, UC Berkeley, they all have big, kind of big ones. Arizona State University, University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, University of California at Davis, Colorado School of Mines, no surprise there, University of Colorado Boulder, Colorado State University, Georgia Institute of Technology, Iowa State University, and Texas A&M. There's also, oh yeah, there's this Advanced Energy Consortium that is University of Texas at Austin, Rice University, and then 10 major energy companies. So there's Baker Hughes, BP, ConocoPhillips, Halliburton, Marathon Oil, Occidental, Petróleo Brasileiro, Schlumberger, Royal Dutch Shell, and Total are all part of that consortium. And the kind of interesting thing to me about this report was that they actually got a hold of the contracts between these universities and these companies. And they wanted to look at, you know, kind of what exactly are universities agreeing to here?
When you say they, do you mean the people who wrote this report, the one that came out?
The people who wrote this report, yeah, the Center for American Progress. So they got a hold of the contracts between the universities and these energy companies. And it says in 9 of the 10 energy research agreements we analyzed, the university partners failed to retain majority academic control over the central governing body charged with directing the university industry alliance. 4 of the 10 alliances actually gave the industry sponsors full governance control. That's outrageous to me, you know, that like, and you know, whenever I talk to people about this, they're kind of like, well, you know, universities are strapped for research funding and we don't want this funding to go away, especially if there's nothing to replace it, which I, of course, agree with. And also there's this idea of like, well, you know, oil companies should be the ones that are funding research into climate change solutions, which I also agree with. The problem for me is that they don't give this money with no strings attached. If they were giving it to some sort of like fund and then the fund just did whatever they thought was best, I don't think we'd even be talking about this. But this thing of, you know, they're asking for input on the research agenda, and that's what they're buying with this money. That's the part that I think is fairly concerning. The other thing that jumps out at me here says none of the 10 agreements requires faculty research proposals to be evaluated and awarded funding based on independent expert peer review, the traditional method for awarding academic and scientific research grants fairly and impartially based on scientific merit. So they're not abiding by sort of the standard protocol of research funding. And yeah, it's definitely concerning. I know when I talked to Stanford about this and sent several questions about their, they have, let's see, I'm going to have to look up. I can tell you also what their publicist said to me, because I was kind of shocked by it. And this actually, I was talking to, this was in the context of, I was doing some research for the episode of the podcast where I talked to Ben and Jeffrey. So let's see. It's called GCEP, the Global Climate and Energy Project. So it says the very first line of this note that she sent me, which is about their project selection process, says the Global Climate and Energy Project and its sponsors have worked together to create a project selection process. So their sponsors have been involved in the creating the entire process by which they evaluate proposals. And then she sent me this flow chart that shows like the approval process, and the sponsor management committee has final approval of every project.
Okay.
And then, let's see. And then, so it's called the Global Climate and Energy Project, but she made a point of saying that GCEP does not do research on climate science or work on climate science communications. Instead, the program is focused on conducting research to lower greenhouse gas emissions from energy use. So specifically targeted at lowering emissions from the existing kind of energy structure. Which is super, it's very interesting. And they are, I forgot to mention, this is a center that was established by funding from ExxonMobil, which is still the majority funder of the center. Very similar kind of setup at the Carbon Mitigation Initiative at Princeton, which is funded by BP. So there's another university that's involved.
So one could argue that... One could argue that the goal here is to reduce emissions. So in a way, it's a benevolent goal. Do we know if there's any systemic problems if that's all we're focusing on?
I don't know. This is actually something that I think Ben is looking into, is sort of, you know, is this focus somehow kind of connected to extending the status quo? So Ben, actually, I asked Ben about this, and he said, this framing lowering greenhouse gas emissions from energy use is interesting. Who could argue with that? But it's a fossil fuel friendly framing. It could include making oil and gas production more efficient, ramping up gas production in general, and focusing on end use energy efficiency, long a favorite of the fossil fuel industry, the energy equivalent of low tar cigarettes. The program is not focused on reducing reliance on fossil fuels, accelerating clean energy development, or anything directly inimical to the program's fossil fuel industry sponsors. This influence over program mission is an important element of industry funding. So that's interesting. This again is like, this is just Ben's kind of take on it. So I don't have like a document that says, ha ha ha, we're doing this to keep oil production going. But I think, I don't know. It's been a while since I looked at this too. So I'd be interested to go back and see what they've funded from 2018 to now and see if there's any kind of trend there in terms of the stuff that they seem to have a preference for.
So the goal here is to produce research that does ultimately get published in peer-reviewed journals. So there is some degree of checking at that end. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. But there again, that's also kind of, you know, there's, I don't know, this is such a thorny area because there's a long history of doing totally legitimate research that also derails progress on, you know, climate action. You saw it in tobacco too. Like there was a bunch of tobacco funding that went towards cancer research into all the various other causes of cancer. That research was totally valid, but it did also help the industry continue to say, you know, well, it might not just be tobacco.
You know? So it was useful for the continuation of that industry.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. And I think you're kind of seeing a similar thing here where it's like, it's not bad to research carbon capture or emissions reductions or algae biofuels or anything like that. It's just a little bit questionable as to, you know, are we researching the things that would most quickly move the needle? Or are we researching the things that are the most comfortable for the oil industry?
So is there now a counter movement with environmental foundations donating money to universities to promote other types of research?
Well, I think there's just a huge money mismatch there. I mean, environmental organizations, yes, like they want to donate too, but they don't have the kind of money that the oil and gas industry has, you know.
Right.
They're outspent, I think, 10 to 1 on the sort of communications and advertising front. And I would imagine it's probably similar on the research side. So you'd sort of just have this David and Goliath problem. And it is unfortunate that there is not another, you know, constituency that has the kind of money to provide this kind of funding if it were to go away. One thing that's been talked about is that as part of a lot of the sort of climate liability cases that are ongoing and various other kind of climate litigation efforts, and or as a policy move, that the oil and gas companies could be required to provide funding that they don't have control over. So that is something that's been discussed, but I think that, I mean, that would pretty much only happen if it was kind of like a legal requirement or a policy requirement. I don't think they're going to make that. I don't think they're going to make that decision on their own.
Right. So stepping away from higher ed, you've written a really popular article called How the Fossil Fuel Industry Got the Media to Think Climate Change Was Debatable, which is also sort of the gist of a big part of season one, and I think season three, to be fair, as well. So can you talk a bit about what we know? I mean, I know it's hard to summarize because you've got 10 hours of podcast there, but what's the gist of what we know about that?
Well, there's really, it is, I would say also, season one and season three, and that's an interesting, scenario where basically the industry, you know, has all of these different tactics, one of which is science denial, but they have lots of other tactics too, and they sort of lean on one or the other depending on what is playing well. So as you're sort of seeing the science denial thing not really working anymore, that you're seeing sort of a resurgence of these kind of old propaganda efforts that they've been deploying for decades. So there is, you know, getting the media to think that climate change was debatable, there is a specific guy, his name was Herb Schmertz. He worked for Mobil Oil, and he kind of created this whole idea that if you didn't like how your company was being covered, you could sort of bully journalists into overcorrecting in your favor. So he talks about this in a book that he wrote. We also found some old footage of him doing an interview after he had left Mobil. So he might have been feeling a bit more like he could share this information.
Right.
I don't know. But he said, you know, I would attack them because I wanted them to cover Mobil's point of view. And unfortunately, it worked really well. You know, journalists weren't necessarily used to this at the time, and they were a little bit more, you know, sensitive to being accused of, he would often accuse them of either bias or he'd find some like small inaccuracy in the story and use that as sort of leverage to make them feel bad about the story in general and kind of overcorrect. And then, you know, the papers that did try to stand up to him, he went totally nuclear on. Like there's this interesting kind of meeting that he talks about in his book where he met with the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal because he felt like they had been unfair to Mobil in their coverage. And he got like, you know, 5 minutes into the conversation, and the executive editor just told him, "Everything you're saying is bullshit." And so the meeting was over, but he went on to, I mean, he pulled all advertising from the Wall Street Journal, but he also removed all access for Wall Street Journal reporters. So he took them off of any press release list. He wouldn't answer any questions from Wall Street Journal reporters. He wouldn't even give like earnings numbers to them. So it made it hard for them to do their jobs. And, you know, within a couple of years, that editor was gone and Mobil was advertising in the Wall Street Journal again. And, you know, the Wall Street Journal was running slightly more Mobil-friendly stories. So Yeah. I mean, at that time, the Wall Street Journal wasn't owned by Rupert Murdoch. Now it's like, of course they're running mobile friendly stories.
Right. You know? Right.
But, yeah. So you definitely, there is this sort of history of the industry really sort of creating and then leveraging false equivalents. And it really took the media a long time to get over that. The print media really just stopped kind of doing this, you know, the last 3 to 5 years, I would say. And then the cable news guys are still doing it. They're still kind of engaging in this, we need to hear the other side kind of thinking. So yeah, we're not done with it yet.
And there is a debate now about divesting from fossil fuels. So one story earlier this month was that Georgetown University pledged to divest from them. And then I think you did an episode about how The Guardian, the newspaper, is also not running ads by them. Have you received feedback from listeners of the Drilled podcast who've tried to work to get their institution to divest from fossil fuels? And do you have a sense of whether they've succeeded or not?
Yeah, actually, I think you're seeing a real resurgence of divestment again. You know, the UC system just announced that they were going to entirely divest. But the thing that's interesting is, I'm not sure how that intersects with this research divestment piece, because I know that there have been campuses where, you know, they're sort of stock portfolios have retirement and pension funds have divested from fossil fuels, but they're still taking money for research. And I do kind of think that like that the divestment movement in general needs to include this research component. And actually Ben and Jeffrey both started out in the campus divestment movement. And I think that's why they've been kind of focused on this research thing for a while, because they've seen how, you know, okay, even when we get, you know, a campus to divest, there's still this whole research component. I've heard from a couple people who have tried to raise the question, and generally the answer is basically, well, where, like, do you have suggestions for replacing this funding? Because it's either we take this money or we shut this program down. You know, so I think it is kind of a tough situation, because at this point, in a lot of these cases, the majority of the funding is coming from the fossil fuel industry. So you're really looking at, you know, if we get rid of this funding, then we have to shut down this whole research center. I don't know.
I could imagine if the focus of a university is engineering. So if it's a polytechnic institute or engineering university.
Right. Or like the School of Mining.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like how are they, that's not going to happen, you know? And I think MIT has actually made several public comments about this, because they actually, I think they might take the most money from fossil fuel companies. So they've been pretty open about saying, you know, like, yeah, we're not going to stop taking money from fossil fuel companies. These companies need the technology to act on climate. And we think it's like good that we're working with them to supply that. And they kind of, I think a lot of it too is like, they don't want to appear, it's very similar to the journalism realm, really. They don't want to appear biased, and they don't want to appear political. And so that gets, which, you know, is valid in some ways, but it definitely gets used kind of to industry's benefit sometimes.
So what do you expect to see happening over the next decade in terms of movement here?
Sure, really. I think you're starting to see some more attention on it, really in large part due to Ben and Jeffrey's work. I know that they're working on another study about this stuff, so it'll be interesting to see what they turn up. I think what they were looking at was really pulling together kind of a comprehensive review of what the universities that do have a lot of fossil fuel funding have been researching, to see if they can draw out any trends in that realm, you know, and see like, is this really shifting the focus? And is that focus not necessarily what the science is telling us is the best way to go? So that should be interesting. And then I don't know, I do think we might see the sort of campus divestment movement starting to take this on. You're really starting to see activists looking at areas that they just weren't looking at before. So like, I think this research piece is part of that, but you're even seeing stuff like people kind of going after the tech industry for supplying software to these companies, which is something I hadn't even really thought about. And it almost seems like initially I'm kind of like, oh, come on, you know, what are they supposed to like not be allowed to use Microsoft Word or something, you know?
Right.
But it's an interesting approach, you know, that like I'm talking.
Was Microsoft one of the companies they were going after?
It actually wasn't. It was Autodesk is one of the companies. So Amazon and Autodesk are the two that I've seen kind of, become targets in this way. And with Amazon, of course, there's like the shipping emissions and all of that, but there's also their server emissions. And then, they're like the web hosting platform for like almost every company at this point. So there's that. And part of that was also that they do business with the oil and gas companies, and they provide oil and gas companies with technology services too. So part of the ask from the Amazon employees for climate, for example, was that they, you know, stop doing business with fossil fuel companies. And then on the Autodesk side, there's a guy in Belgium who lives near the largest mine in Europe and had, you know, kind of been looking into how that mine operates and whatever, and realized that they use Autodesk software for all of their kind of operations and mine planning and all that kind of stuff, which, you know, Autodesk has long positioned itself as sort of a company that's aligned with sustainability and that's like enabling sustainable building and all of this kind of stuff. So he has been kind of waging a one-man campaign, but it's starting to get some traction. And he's sort of like, you know, Autodesk should not be supplying software that basically enables more efficient mining. So I don't know. It's interesting. I don't know what I think about that yet, but it's definitely an interesting development in sort of how the next wave of activists are attacking the issue.
And this is my last question. What are your plans for season 4 and future seasons of Drilled?
Well, I have actually, you know, when I first started Drilled, it was going to be a limited release, one season thing. And then when I started doing the research, I was like, wow, there are actually so many stories contained in just sort of the climate accountability space and what are the things that have stopped us from acting on climate. So I do have several stories planned for the future. There's one is about a particular case. Another is about an egregious and crazy pipeline project. And I'm doing, you know, I can't say too much because I'm doing some ongoing reporting around, you know, the automotive industry, some other oil companies that haven't been in the press so much, and, you know, building some future seasons around those too.
Great. Well, Amy, it's been great having you on the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you so much for your patience with the schedule.
Oh, you're welcome.
You can follow Amy at Amy Westervelt on Twitter. You can also find her podcasts and other podcasts in the Critical Frequency Network at criticalfrequency.org. If you enjoyed listening to the show, please leave us a review on iTunes because it helps spread the word about the show. And as always, you can reach me at podcast@heterodoxacademy.org and follow me on Twitter at ChrisMartin76. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is produced by Heterodox Academy. Find us online at heterodoxacademy.org, on Twitter at HDXAcademy, and on Facebook. This podcast is for informational purposes only and doesn't represent the views of Heterodox Academy.